Isaiah 57, starting in verse 13, actually. Isaiah 57, beginning in verse 13, let's read it. But when thou criest, he's talking about the wicked ones that we talked about last week. When thou criest, let thy companies deliver thee. I think he's talking about his idols. Let your idols deliver you, O wicked ones. But the wind shall carry them all away. Vanity shall take them away. Do you see? Now the next word is what? But. Now we're going to move to a different folks, you see. Now we're going to talk about the righteous. And he says, but he that putteth his trust in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain and shall say, cast ye up, prepare the way, take up the stumbling block out of the way of who? My people. So now we're talking about God's people here. For thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones. For I will not contend forever, neither will I be always wroth, for the spirit should fail before me and the souls which I have made. For the iniquity of his covetousness was I wroth. Now he's talking about the wicked ones again. I was wroth and I smote him. I hid me and was wroth, and he went on frowardly in the way of his heart. I have seen his ways and will heal him. Now he's talking about healing. I will lead him also and restore comforts unto him and to his mourners. I create the fruit of the lips. Peace, peace to him that is far off. Who would that be, do you think? Him that is far off. Gentiles. And to him that is near, Jews, saith the Lord, and I will heal him. But the wicked, see how he kind of bounces back and forth a little bit. But the wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. Now, in the passage for last week, you probably remember that we saw watchmen. Do you remember that? Let's just draw it on the board again so we all get it in our mind. There were these watchmen stationed around, and what were they watching over? Do you remember? Yeah, they were watching over sheep. That's sort of implied in the passage because these watchmen are also called shepherds. And so you have these watchmen that are watching, and the sheep there are in the fold. The only trouble with the watchmen, I shouldn't say the only trouble, because they had lots of troubles, but one of the troubles of the watchmen were that they were blind. You remember 56 verse 10? The watchmen are called blind. Now that doesn't make for a very good watchman when you're blind, but they were also characterized in verse 10 as dumb dogs, meaning that if someone did come to attack, why, they couldn't even bark. You see, they weren't very good watchmen. If that wasn't bad enough, they were sleepy dogs in verse 10. So you had a watchdog that lays down on his back, feet up in the air, goes to sleep. He's not watching too much. But this wasn't the worst part. These watchmen were greedy dogs. Do you remember that? These watchmen actually represent the leaders, the teachers, the false prophets and all that were charged with watching out for Israel. They were greedy dogs. They were out for their own gain. That's in verse 11. They were out for their own gain. Sounds like some of our own political leaders, doesn't it? Setting up foundations so you can profit, you see. The establishment political class, you might say. And this is the way it was in Israel in those days. But on top of all that, the watchmen were drunkards in verse 12. They said, let's go get some wine. And by the way, when you go out to get your wine, get strong wine, you see. And so they drank the wine until they were filled with that. And they also said in verse 12, we've got it made. I suppose what that means is we're holding the high offices. here in Israel. Boy, don't we have it made. And guess what? Tomorrow's going to be a good day too. Perhaps they will extort some more money tomorrow. More money from the people. The only trouble is that there were beasts lurking around the flock. You remember in verse 9, 56:9, we had beasts that are lurking around the flock. And the beasts were hungry and they were eyeing the flock. And you remember what happened? Suddenly a voice commanded the beast to do what? Attack. So he says, come to devour. And so the beasts were commanded to attack and devour the flock. What is surprising here is that the one who issued this command to the beasts to devour the flock was who? Do you remember? God. It was God. It's God that's speaking in this context. And God instructs the beasts to attack the sheep. And not only attack them, devour them. Obviously, this passage is about God's judgment upon the watchmen and the flock. The watchmen are the leaders in Israel, the ones who should have been watching out. The scribes, the priests, the religious leaders, the teachers in Israel who were without understanding. They didn't really know God's word. They ended up rejecting God's Son, so they didn't know the Father either. And so they were without understanding. It says they were ignorant. And God said to the beasts, come to devour. And it's a very sad thing that Israel, the nation, has come to this, isn't it? You would never have expected it. It started out in such a promising way when God called Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees and God miraculously gave Abraham a son. And Abraham's son Isaac had a son whose name was Jacob. Then we had Moses that brought them out of Egypt. And God showed them all kinds of miraculous signs. God gave Israel the law. And they all lifted their hand and said, we'll do it. And you never would have thought it would have come to this, would you? They didn't do the law. And for 1,500 years, we saw how Israel proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that man cannot obey the law. You see, man is a fallen creature. The very nature of man has been corrupted. And we don't even know how much, you see. We walk around thinking that we're pretty good fellows, you see, but we don't even know the depth of corruption that has penetrated the heart of man. That's why the Bible says that, what verse am I thinking about? My mind.
Deceitful.
Yeah, the heart is desperately wicked. Deceitful and desperately wicked, yes. Who could even know it? Right. And God took this little sampling of people called Israel, and demonstrated to the world that under the law of God, man is helpless and hopeless and cursed. Most of all, God demonstrated that man needs a Savior. If we learn anything from Israel, we should understand that, you see. That's what the law did, after all. It pointed us to Christ. It showed us the futility of law-keeping as a way of salvation. Oh, how they tried to do it. Paul says they were zealous to do it, but they couldn't do it. It shows us the futility of ceremonies and works to gain acceptance with God. And trying futilely to keep the law, Israel fell into the depths of sin. The Jews liked to say, we are the children
of Abraham.
But I want you to look what God says about them in Isaiah 57:3. But draw near hither, ye sons of who? Abraham? No, sorcerers. The seed of the adulterer. You're just a child of the adulterer and the whore. God said, you are the sons of evildoers. And then he goes on in the next several verses and describes their sin to us. They were mockers in verse 4. Remember that? Open mouths, their tongues wagging. Mockers, they were idol worshipers in verses 5 through 8. By the way, do you remember where they put up their idols in the next few verses? Yes, that's the first place. Virtually, they put them up everywhere. They put them in the green trees. Then they put them down in the streams, in the riverbeds where they found the smooth stones, remember? Then they went up into the mountains and they built their idols there. And finally, they put them on their doorposts. Every time they came into their house, they had their idols tacked up on their doorpost, you see, so that when they left and when they came back, they could give honor to the idols. This is not the heathen we're talking about. This is Israel. Elijah thought that everyone else in Israel had bowed the knee to who? Baal, and they had, except for 7,000. Not only did they fall that far, but they sacrificed their own children, apparently, to Moloch, a heathen god. In verse 5, rather than trusting God, they negotiated peace treaties with kings. Come on down, king of Assyria, let's see if we can make a treaty. We can't trust our God anymore. And after all the sin and wickedness and idolatry, they never repented of their sins. They never lost hope, it says in verse 10. They never lost hope in their own wicked ways and in their own idols. You would have thought, finally, they would have become frustrated with their idols. Their idols couldn't do anything for them. But they never lost hope in their idols. And so last week, the scene that we looked at featured the wicked in Israel and the judgment of God that would surely fall on them. But then we came to verse 13, and in the middle of the verse, God turned and looked at another group. Let's read verse 13 again. But when thou criest, let thy companies deliver thee, but the wind shall carry them all away, vanity shall take them, but he that putteth his trust in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain. This is the picture that we always put up on the board. If the nation of Israel is a circle, many of them are wicked, but there's a portion of the group that still trusts God, you see. The Bible calls them a remnant because they're the smaller portion. Nevertheless, there are two groups in Israel, like there are in every nation, I suppose. There's the wicked and the righteous, and they live side by side. And we see both of those in verse 13. But now God is going to change focus from this group, the wicked group, to who? The righteous group. God turns around now and looks at these people in verse 13. So let's talk about who he's speaking to here. You notice that in verse 13, he is speaking to those that put their trust in me. Do you see that in verse 13? So he's speaking to he that putteth his trust in me. They're also described as humble and contrite a couple of verses later. That's just the very nature of a righteous man. Did you know that? You can just equate the two, you see. The man that trusts is the man that is what? Humble. And it only makes sense, you see, because the only man that trusts in God really is the man that recognizes that he himself is nothing. And therefore, you trust the one who is everything. And so the righteous man is, by nature, a humble and contrite man. Not that there are not differences in personalities, but deep within you, you are humble and contrite before God. Now we're going to see one of the chief characteristics of the righteous. They are humble. I just talked about that. So we see in this passage that the object of the discussion are those who trust in God. They're the humble ones. So even though great judgment is coming upon the wicked, yet God has a different reward for his humble servants. What is coming on this group? Judgment. The wind's going to carry them away, right? They're going to depend on their companies, their idols, who can't help them at all. The wind's just going to carry them away to judgment. But now we're going to talk about the reward of these people. What do they get? Do they get judgment? No. Their reward is found in verse 13. But he that putteth his trust in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain. Now, so we come back to the same question that we always come on. Are we just talking about inheriting the physical land of Israel and worshiping on that little hill called Zion there in Israel? That's what always seems to come up. And in the sense that these words were spoken in the context of the Jewish people before the Babylonian captivity, they certainly may apply in a temporal way to those Jews who returned from Babylon. Some of the Jews, not many of them, compared to the big number, a few of them came back down and they occupied Jerusalem again on that hill called Zion, built the wall and so forth. But this whole passage, this whole redemption passage, which is centered around Christ, it seems to apply more fully to the greater inheritance, you see, the thing that the land really typified, the thing that that hill over there typifies. And so it seems to me that there is a bigger inheritance in mind here than just that little strip of land and just that little hill. It always pointed toward that greater inheritance, which is in heaven. By the way, did you know that all of those Old Testament saints desired something better than the land of Canaan? They desired a heavenly country. Take a look at Hebrews 11:16. Hebrews 11:16. But now they, that is these ones that he's been talking about, these faithful, desire a better country, that is a what? Heavenly country. Notice it's a better country. Better than what? Better than anything that we can find on this earth. They desire a better country, that is a heavenly, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. He's prepared for them a city. Guess where that city is? It's in heaven. It's that city which hath foundations in verse 10, Hebrews 11 and 10, whose builder and maker is God. And so even those Old Testament saints, they looked unto that heavenly place. The Jews in the Old Testament had their capital city on this little hill called Mount Zion. It was a little hill. They built their city on it. Jerusalem was built on that little hill. But the saints of all ages have always had their eyes on another Zion. And this is what the New Testament teaches. Take a look at Hebrews 12:22. Hebrews 12:22 says, "But you are come unto Mount Zion and unto the city of the living God, the," what? "Heavenly Jerusalem." So that's what that's what it's really all about, you see. That's where we really want to end up, in that heavenly Jerusalem. And so in the grander sense here, God's humble servants will inherit that heavenly land and that heavenly Zion. So here's the deal. We live in this fallen world, so we're down here on our board. We live in this fallen world. Here we are with corrupted hearts, with a sin nature. And God has to get us up here to a place called Zion, that is ultimately the heavenly Zion, you see. And God has got to get us there. And the question is, how is He going to do it? And we have this analogy that's in our text, and it is the analogy of building a road to get there. So the idea is that God is going to build a road for you and you and you and you and me to travel. And so we see that God's going to make a road. Take a look at verse 14. It says, "And shall say, cast ye up, cast ye up." Now that doesn't mean much to us, but, and I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but apparently the words have the idea of building something up. "Prepare the way." Now we're starting to sort of understand what he's saying. "Prepare the way, take up the stumbling block out of the way of my people." Now, it's a little difficult to discern in verse 14 who is speaking, isn't it? Because it just says, "and shall say." There's no subject there. In the previous verse, God was speaking, and so it appears that God is still speaking in verse 14, and God says to build a road. And then he says, "Prepare the way." Prepare the highway, you might say. This verse is very similar to Isaiah 40 and verse 3. If you want to thumb back, Isaiah 40 verse 3 says, "The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God." And so here in our text, God is commanding that a highway be built. When he says, "cast ye up," the idea is to build up the road. And that's kind of the way we do these days. They haul in dirt, they build it up. If you wanted to cross over marshland or even a body of water, you would have to build up the land. You'd have to build a causeway, they call it, so that you could cross over. And so God is saying, build a road. Prepare the way. Now, if this were a modern road, the construction people would come in with and grade it and smooth it and lay a gravel foundation and then pave it. And finally, we could travel right down that road, you see. Finally, there would be a beautiful road on which to travel. And this is what God is saying. Build it up and prepare the way. Why? Because we have somewhere to go. You see, we're going to possess the land. We're going to live on God's holy mountain. Now, if there is anything in the way in the road, what does God say to do with it? Remove it, right? Remove the stumbling blocks. Bring in the heavy equipment and remove anything that is in the way. Now, if you were driving down the expressway at night, you really don't want to run into a tree in the middle of the expressway, do you? And this is what God is saying. If there's any stumbling block that would keep us from getting here, what's God going to do? Remove it. Prepare the way and remove all the stumbling blocks. I want you to know, notice here, who God is doing this for. Is he doing it for the wicked that we talked about last week? No, they're going to be blown away in the wind. But it says, and shall say, cast ye up, prepare the way, take up the stumbling block out of the way of who? My people. Isn't it good to be God's people? God is not making a road for the wicked. God will let their idols deliver them if they can. The wind will carry the wicked away, and the wicked will never get to the promised land, and they will never get to the holy mountain of God. But God makes a road for the righteous to get there. It must be a very good road, built up and prepared for God's people. All the stumbling blocks are taken out of the way. Let me just say this tonight. If God has chosen you, if God has set his affection on you from all eternity, if God has made you his people, if he has prepared a place for you in heaven, like Jesus said he was going to do, then God is going to get you there, right? God is going to get you there. He didn't do all that for nothing. So he's going to build a road. He's going to remove all the stumbling blocks. Back in the pioneer days, they didn't have roads when they crossed the country. And if they set out to travel west, they usually didn't make it, you see. There were too many obstacles, too many stumbling blocks in the way. Lots of Indians. And God's people have an even more treacherous journey. Yes, we do. We have to travel through this fallen world. And there are many Indians in this world. And I'm not against Indians. Hope nobody's offended. There are snakes all along the way. There are unforeseen obstacles. But God goes out before us and he makes a road. I think that's what this is saying here. And he builds it up and he prepares it so that we have a road to that heavenly place. When we finally find ourselves in heaven, surrounded by angels, walking on golden streets, fellowshipping with one another there, we're going to wonder, how in the world did we make it through all the trouble? I think we'll look back and say, wow, how did we make it? How did sinners such as us end up in a place like this? And the answer will be that God made you a road. And he removed all the obstacles that would have caused you to fall. Pardon me? He is the way, yes. In this particular analogy, it's sort of an analogy of a road, which we all understand is not a literal road, but... Yeah, yes. But we will, God removes all the obstacles that would have caused us to fall. Now we've fallen down several times, many times in temptations, but how many times has God taken out of the way temptations that would have caused you to fall away into apostasy, you see? We don't even know. God goes out in front of us and removes those stumbling blocks that would have caused us to fall away unto perdition. God goes out in his foresight and in his providence, and he clears the way for us. I think back on my Christian life, so many things could have pulled me the other direction. In the end, we end up in his holy mountain. This is God restoring sinners to himself, you see, and bringing them there. The type was God returning Jews from Babylon to Jerusalem. You understand what I'm saying? There's some truth in that, but that's just the type. What is the substance? The substance is God saving sinners and bringing them to the real heavenly place. Now the question is, how can we be sure that we will finally get to the promised land? How can we be sure that this will really happen? That God will go out before us to take out the stumbling blocks? The answer is that God has promised it. Take a look at verse 15. For thus saith the high and lofty one. Let's get the context. Isaiah 57, let's start in verse 14. And shall say, cast ye up, prepare the way, take up the stumbling block out of the way of my people. For thus saith the high and lofty one. I should have started at the end of verse 13 where he says that you're going to inherit the land. You're going to inherit the land, the last phrase of verse 13. And then he says, for, in verse 15, thus saith the high and lofty one, you see. This is really the only way that we can know for sure, you see. Can you trust yourself? We're too weak. But if God is for us, then that makes all the difference. If God says, I will bring you to the promised land, then that's my assurance. I don't look down within myself for assurance. All I find there are a lot of question marks. But if you look to God's word and he says, I will do it, and you hold to that by faith, you see, that's our assurance. If God says, I'm going to build you a road, then that's our hope. If God says, I will remove the stumbling blocks, then I have assurance. But of course, if I'm depending on my own works, my own religious services, my own rituals, my own efforts, my own ability to overcome all the obstacles, then I have every reason to doubt that I'll ever get there. I was going to sing a song tonight, and of course that song is, My Hope is Built on Nothing Less Than Jesus' Blood and Righteousness. I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on Jesus' name. On Christ, the solid rock I stand, all other ground is sinking sand, all other ground is sinking sand. And in our text, God says that he will bring his people to the promised land. Isn't that what he says? In verse 13, isn't that what he says? Those that trust in me. Shall possess the land. He's going to build them a road to get there. He's going to prepare the way. He's going to remove the stumbling blocks. And how can we be sure? Because he has said it. For thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity. But also, we have assurance because of who God is. That's why we have such a lofty verse in verse 15. In verse 15, for thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place. Why do you think that's there? I think what it's doing is it's assuring us that God can do this because he is the transcendent one. He is high and lofty and inhabits eternity. We're going to talk about two theological words in the next couple of minutes. Transcendence. I think it's an Yeah. There you go. Something like that. Transcendence and immanence. We're going to see both of those in our text, and I want to explain these to you. One of the reasons that we can trust our God is that he is transcendent. Now, what do we mean by that? We mean that he lives outside of this world. God is not bound by the constraints of this world. If he were, then he would have all kinds of limitations. And we might not be sure that he could even save us, you see. But God is not affected by the forces of this world. Is God affected by the gravitational force? No. Is he affected by centrifugal force? No. Nor is he affected by all the laws of science. He is not affected by the usual constraints of this world. And therefore, what is impossible for us, because we are subject, what is impossible for us is easy for him, because he transcends the whole thing. So if his universe is pictured this way, if that's the limits of his universe, where does God reside? Out here. I'm sorry? Yes, and that's a good thought, and we're going to get to that in a minute. Some people think that this is God remains outside of his universe and he doesn't interfere. Those people are called what, Brother Mark? Deists. God just spun the top. Now he's going to let it go and see where it goes, you see. But we know that that's not the case. But the first, we do acknowledge that God is transcendent. He lives outside of all of that. And therefore, he is not controlled by the forces in here, but he controls the forces in here, you see. And so that's sort of what we mean when we say that God is transcendent. Now, you and I are mired in a fallen world. We are in this world. We're up to our necks in it. We are chained by our own sin natures, and there's no way that we can find our way to the promised land. There is no way that we can do it. But can God do it? Yes, God can do the impossible, and he can get us there. Nothing is too hard for him, because he is the one who sits outside of this world and who controls it. So the universe is pictured as a curtain stretched out to its limits, and that's exactly how the Bible portrays it in Isaiah 40:22. God stretches out the curtain of the universe, you see. But that's a finite universe, and God lives outside of that finiteness, outside of those limits. And he's a force that operates on the universe. However, the universe does not operate upon God. God created the whole thing. The key idea in the idea of transcendence is distance. There is a great distance between me and God. He's a long way away in his transcendence, you see. So the idea in transcendence is distance. In fact, there's a great distance between God and this universe. His power is far greater than the power of this universe or the power of any of his creatures. There's just a tremendous gulf between who God is and who we are. And this is the God who says, "I will build you a road to heaven. I will prepare you a way, and I will remove all the stumbling blocks." But also, I think you're going to see in our text that God can be trusted to save us because of his immanence. Now, what we mean by immanence is that God works in this universe. He doesn't just create it and spin it on its way, and he sits back with his arms crossed and says, "I wonder what'll happen." He doesn't leave it to its own courses, you see. But God works in the universe. So this is what Marion, I think, was getting to is he's not only transcendent, but also immanent. Not only does he work in his universe, but he works within hearts. We all understand that, you see. But God, as great as God is and as far off as he is in his transcendence, look how near he is in his immanence, you see. He works in us. Right, and that's what we're getting at here. Notice where God dwells in verse 15. He dwells in the high and holy place, right? That is, in the eternal chambers outside the confines of this universe. But where else does he dwell in verse 15? With him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit. In such sinners as you and I, in such weak vessels as you and I. And he revives the heart of the contrite one. So we believe in a God who works in his universe and he works in hearts. That's why he is able to bring his people all the way from this world to that faraway place called heaven. We know here that salvation is a work of God from beginning to end, don't we? He chooses his people, then he sends his Redeemer to die for his people, then he sends the Holy Spirit to penetrate the heart of his people, just like he said here, I'm with my contrite ones. And he regenerates them, and he sanctifies them, and he keeps them, you see. And doing all of this proves both his transcendence and his immanence. God can also be trusted to save us because his anger finally comes to an end. Do you see that? It says in verse 16, "For I will not contend forever." Is God always and forever against us? No. "Neither will I always be wroth." So at least we know this about God. He's not going to be angry forever, perhaps. Why? How horrible would that be if we were the objects of his wrath forever? What if a mother was the kind of person that could never forgive her children? What if she got angry every time her children disobeyed and her anger would burn forever? The child steals a cookie from the cookie jar when he's 2 years old, and when he's 40 years old, she's still mad about it, you see. What if we had a God like that? But the fact of the matter is that God can come to an end of his anger. God can control himself. God can set his anger aside for his people, and God will forgive you. He says, "I will not contend forever, neither will I always be wroth." God can be trusted to save us because he sees our helpless condition. Take a look at verse 16. Let's look at it a little more closely. "I will not contend forever, neither will I be always wroth, for," here's what would happen if his anger continued forever, "the Spirit should fail before me." Whose spirit? Mine and yours. The spirits of his creatures would disintegrate in his anger. Your soul and your spirit would be done away. All the souls that God created, if God could never forgive sin, if his anger endured forever. So we see our helpless condition there, you see. If there was no way for God to put away his anger, then his whole creation of human souls would utterly perish. We cannot survive under the anger of God. I can barely survive when my wife is mad at me, you see. How can I survive if my God is angry with me forever? But God will not be angry forever, and this implies that there is a satisfaction made for sin, you see. There was something done that allowed God to come to an end of His anger. There must be something to appease the anger of God, and there is something, and who is it? It's Jesus, and it's the Redeemer that we saw in chapter 53, the suffering Redeemer. And now God will not be angry forever. Almost through. Even in Israel, God can save. Let's read verse 17. For the iniquity of His covetousness was I wroth. Remember how He was angry with the wretched ones back in early part of chapter 57? With the watchmen and so forth. The iniquity of His covetousness was I wroth and smote Him. I hid me and was wroth, and He went on forwardly in the way of His heart. He kept on sinning. I have seen His ways and will heal Him. I will lead Him also and restore comforts unto Him and to His mourners. Of course, we understand that He is not utterly forsaking Israel, right? There is going to be a redemption for Jews. So we have the circle. God is not going to utterly forsake all, but He is going to save His people. I have seen His ways and will heal Him. I will lead Him also and restore comforts unto Him and to His mourners. I create the fruit of the lips, peace, peace to him that is far off. Now see, now it's extending on to the Gentiles, talking about redemption in its fullest sense. I'm going to redeem the Gentiles and the Jews, saith the Lord, and I will heal him. But the wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There's no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. All right, we're out of time.